Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. There's a big difference between a solution that measures a fundraiser's performance and a solution that helps a fundraiser perform. QBAC helps fundraisers to excel at their most critical task, developing deep, meaningful relationships with donors and cultivating them into lifelong givers. Give your fundraisers a better qualified portfolio, one that considers more than just capacity and simple scoring. Your fundraisers will also get insights into the hearts, minds, and connections of their donors. Fundraisers have a tough job. Help them close bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Podcast listeners, the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow is finally back on the schedule. We have several dates confirmed. Since 2014, our team has been providing high-quality one-day roadshows in partnership with nonprofit leaders who want to showcase their space and provide thought-provoking and highly interactive fundraising training in their nonprofit community. Our roadshows have been described by our guest as hands down the best professional development experience that they have ever been a part of. This experience has been described as challenging assumptions with conversation-inspiring content and new ways of thinking. If you would like to register for one of the upcoming stops on the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow, just visit the link in the show notes. Good morning, Jim. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have just connected here this morning, had a few minutes of conversation, but like a lot of my guests here, this is our first official conversation. It's as if you and I are sharing our first cup of coffee. I literally have a nice one in hand with me. I'm looking forward to our conversation this morning. Tim, how about before we get started, we just ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure, Jason. And I'm flattered and pleased to be on your podcast. Thank you so much for inviting me. I also have a cup of coffee. This is the fluid of choice, I would imagine, for many of us in this profession. And I also have a very nice cup of coffee. Again, thanks, Jason, for having me on. Yeah, my name is Jim Cobb. I am vice president for philanthropy at the Edmonite Missions, based in Selma, Alabama. Now, you may ask, what or who are the Edmonite Missions? So the Edmonite Missions was established in 1937 at the direction of the Holy See, actually, of the Vatican. To address the educational, health, and economic deficits experienced by the African American community in the Black Belt of the Deep South. As you know, in the 30s, Jim Crow was largely de rigueur in the Deep South, and as a result of that, the deficits experienced within the African American community were significant, right? And so the Edmonites asked the Society of St. Edmund, a religious order based in Vermont, actually. They are the religious order that runs St. Michael's College. And so two clergymen, a Father Casey and a Father Parrow, got into their car and went down to Selma, Alabama, and established the missions there. And that was, we just celebrated our 85th anniversary. And so we have evolved quite significantly since that time of our founding. We are the largest provider of an integrated suite of social and workforce development programs in the Black Belt of the Deep South. We have four primary kind of foci for our programs, Jason: education, workforce development, health, and nutrition. And we've been based in Selma since then and work. Really, our impact is in four counties in and around Dallas County in Selma, and our work really serves as a model for a lot of the work being done in that region. So that's who the Edmonite missions are.
Fascinating, Jim. And in your when you and I were exchanging some information, you shared with me that you also, this is the first reference that somebody has made, that you served on a fundraising team for the World War I Memorial of the National Mall. Tell me a little bit about that, if you don't
mind. Yeah, that was an amazing experience. So I worked for a while, Jason, for several years, for a consulting firm in New York called Changing Our World, which is a philanthropic management and consultancy firm. They're part of the Omnicom family of companies. I had the great fortune. I had just finished doing work with both Sesame Street Children's Television Workshop and with the UN Foundation. And we received a call from a gentleman named Daniel Dayton, who was executive director of the World War I Centennial Commission that was established by congressional order under the Obama administration to raise funds to build a memorial, national memorial, to celebrate and to honor the sacrifices of American servicemen and women from the First World War. And I had the great fortune of being a senior member on that team for several years. The fundraising goal, you're testing my memory here, I think was $50 million to build that memorial. Now, the National Mall is closed, so the memorial actually was built in Freedom, right off of Freedom Plaza. And the memorial, we raised the funds. We had an amazing advisory board made up of Secretary Leon Panetta, Admiral Michael Mullen, General Barry McCaffrey, and a supporting team of about 40 former U.S. ambassadors. Through very hard work and through very generous corporate and individual support, that memorial was, the fundraising goal was reached, and that memorial is now in situ. It was dedicated 2 years ago and should be finished in 2023.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's part of the joy and pleasure of this endeavor here is to have these types of conversations and understand that there is a broad diversity of organizations around our country and around our world doing things like you're doing, both with the mission there and then also in Washington, your previous experience. So, Jim, we ask our guests to come on here with a big idea, bold opinion. Yeah. We don't necessarily ask that you disclose what that might be, and we let the conversation sort of emerge from there. So what do you have for us today?
So I have a bold opinion. So I thought about this. So, you know, I'm never short, as most men my age, I'm never short of opinions. So I do have one for you. And I think the question that has been the foremost of my mind, actually your request for this podcast helped me kind of formulate this into a question, is why are the organizations, and this is a general statement, so I have to qualify it. Why are the organizations in our sector, in the nonprofit sector, afraid of their own obsolescence?
Oh, that's deep. Let me make sure why are today's nonprofit organizations afraid of their own obsolescence? Why are they, or why are they not?
Why are they afraid? So our goal in this sector is to become obsolete, right? I am not effective if I get up every morning as the chief fundraiser for a social services agency, a very large one, and I have to work. I've not been successful, right? I am only successful when I get up and say I can now retire. Right. So building a memorial is easy, right? The thing, you raise the money, it gets built, or raising money for a capital campaign for a building or a cathedral. Once you raise the money and the cathedral's built, you're done, right? But when nonprofit organizations that are dedicated to meeting the societal deficit, right?
Yeah.
Let's look at some statistics here. I think this is important. There are 1.8 million nonprofit organizations in the United States. We've had a 20% growth in that sector in the last 20 years. Okay? Those organizations, they bring in about $85 billion in revenue per annum. That's both contributed and uncontributed revenue, right? They contribute over $1 trillion to the U.S. economy. That's more than 5% of the gross domestic product. from 2006 to 16, the expenses associated within our sector have increased over 50%. And the nonprofit sector represents the third largest workforce in the United States. Would you say that this is a boom industry? Would you say that this is a growth sector? If the goal of a nonprofit organization is to become obsolete, shouldn't these numbers be in retrograde, right? We're in a growth industry. We're in a growth industry, right? So why is that? Why is that? Why are we as an organization or as a sector or organizations within the sector, why are we not going out of business?
Well, Jim, it is. I don't consider it to be any coincidence that last night I teach a social entrepreneurship course over at the local college, and I was talking to my students about this very subject last evening, and I was differentiating between trying to give my students some clarity between the way that I sort of see mission statements versus vision statements consistent with the text that we use for the particular class. And one of the ways that I characterize it is that the vision is sort of that ultimate point. I oftentimes refer to in the class the Santa Monica Pier that's at the end of I-10 on the west, where, you know, on the west, that's as far, far west as you can get on Interstate 10. But I say that, the part of what I say to your point, Jim, is that if the vision is achieved, it puts you out of business. It makes you obsolete. It's unnecessary. You know, you've accomplished your goal. But I think as this relates to fundraising, and I'm guessing this is where we're going to go with this conversation today, I think part of this is also what my critique of contemporary practices are, is that the reason in some ways that we're afraid, my immediate answer to your question is we don't want to have those high expectations. Jim, to put ourselves out of business is to have expectations of ourselves and our donors that perhaps we're afraid to have.
I think, Jason, that may be part of it. I think we have to admit that the nonprofit sector is big business, right? It's big business. It is. It's big business. It's a lucrative business. And I think to some degree,
right. I mean, my suggestion of low expectations is essentially one of perhaps, yes, because I would definitely put the big business, sorry for interrupting you, but yeah, I would definitely put the big business reality. There's a lot of for-profit enterprises that keeping us in business and keeping our hands out asking for more is quite lucrative for them, I guess.
But the for-profit sector is expected to do that in a capitalistic society, right? So a for-profit company is only successful when demand for its services increase, right? Because they are an organization that is driven by, they're an organization that is driven by demand, and that is appropriate, right? That is appropriate, and it is good. I mean, look at your stock prices over the last 6 months, right? So they're an organization driven by demand. We're an industry that's driven by societal deficit and individual and collective need, right? So the longer that we do not deploy programs that really address the predicates of the issues that we exist for, or the issues that give us shape and form and function, then we're just spinning our wheels, right? So the question becomes, I think there are two questions for me, Jason, in this, is that when an organization has a vision statement, every organization has a vision statement, does the organization maintain organizational fidelity to deploying programs that will enable that vision? Okay. Or do organizations become so convinced of their own mythology that they believe that that if the services they provide goes away, then there'll be great harm, right? The goal of an organization should be to get to a point where their services should go away, right, where there's no need for them anymore. But to say to an organization, your job is to go out of business, I had a conversation once with a colleague, And he was telling me how important his organization was. And I said, your organization does important work, but what are you doing to get out of business? And he looked at me and said, well, we can never get out of business. I said, well, you believe your own mythology. You believe your own mythology. So I think it's about deploying programs that are both sustainable and address the predicates of why we exist, right? We need to really ask the question, why do these organizations exist? All right, what are the root causes of the issues that they're addressing? And what programs are they deploying to address the root causes and not just the symptoms of the problem?
Well, I think so, Jim, this writing project that a lot of my guests have heard me talking about that I hope will wrap up here perhaps by the end of the year, I've been really making sense of sort of the history, the 20th century history of how sort of contemporary fundraising practices have really come about. And Jim, the more you sort of get down into the weeds about how our underlying logic is, it's basically a consumer driven sort of mindset that says, like anything in our consumer society, we're never supposed to actually achieve what the product says we're supposed to achieve. There's a certain level of inherent dissatisfaction that's supposed to be built into the products and services that we buy in the marketplace. And unfortunately, Jim, I would say that's the inherent flaw, or one of the inherent flaws in essentially that answers your question, is that we've embraced this notion of consumerism, or the notion that the donor is a consumer, to such an extent that we're fearful, whether we explicitly admit it or not, we're fearful of the idea that if we don't keep the donor dissatisfied, or if perhaps we actually solve some of our problems, how many of us should just be more confident of the fact that if we just solve a couple of these problems that we're always raising money for, there's always another problem around the corner that we can go raise money for. You know, there's an endless number of problems on this sort of this broken planet. Am I right?
I'm trying to conceptualize what you said. I think there's a bit of truth to what you're saying. I think there are threads of truth in there. But I think there's also, at least in the social services sector.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at, I think we treat our donors as being way too fragile, right? So the hardest thing to raise money for is advocacy work, right? Is advocacy work.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, advocacy work drives real change, societal change, right? Eventually. Drives real change. If you look at the civil rights movement in the 1960s, right? What secured the vote, or what gave security to the vote to the African American community in the 1960s was ultimately advocacy work, right? Ultimately was advocacy work at the highest levels, with Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Coalition spending a lot of time in Washington doing a lot of talking and a lot of demonstrations, right? So, but that's the hardest thing to raise money for. And I think when we start looking at these very complex societal issues and trying to talk to our donors about deploying solutions that really address the root causes of these problems, we're afraid of getting them angry. So it's a lot easier to ask somebody, for example, for money for a feeding program than it is to ask somebody for money for a program that really addresses why there are people going hungry in Dallas County, Alabama. All right? We don't want to go down that rabbit hole. I mean, we do, but organizations typically do not. Okay? Typically do not. I mean, if you look at what the 9/11 fund and how they were able finally to secure money for the 9/11 fund, it was through advocacy work, right? Something that shouldn't have had to be advocated.
But Jim, that's kind of my point. The idea that the consumer, so if you think of the donor as the consumer, that's, you and I are speaking the same. I think in a lot of ways, we're probably making the same argument. In a consumer society, the donor/consumer is supposed to feel like they alone are the king, that they can solve all the world's problems. We sort of individualize it. We package it in these neat sort of charity-like packages. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it actually can't get the job done. I mean, that's what Walmart and Amazon and McDonald's does for us, you know, on the consumer side. And I think the flaw in our thinking is we've embraced the same thinking – you know, Walmart and McDonald's are in the business of making sure that we come through those doors every day, buy cheap shit, and always have to come back for more the next day. We're never actually solving the problem. We're never learning how to prepare better food. We're never learning how to buy better products. That's essentially your critique.
Jason, I'm glad you did not include Burger King onion rings in that litany of bad foods, because I would have had to hang up the phone immediately. I think we're putting different colored cloth, the same cloth, different paint job.
I think
the other thing too, Jason, really is that if you look, we don't ask people to solve problems. We ask people to meet need, and there's a difference there. There's a real difference there. If you look at any, I spent 2 years as a senior advancement officer in one of the largest international relief agencies in the world, right? We didn't ask people to address child trafficking. We didn't deploy programs to address child trafficking. We asked people to support safe houses. All right. So we're asking people to meet need. We're not asking people to solve problems. And if you look at how nonprofits talk to each other in this sector, if you start having these conversations, they can get really ugly really fast. You know, for example, feeding programs. The problem with feeding programs, both in this country and internationally, is that we're feeding people, but we're not nourishing them.
Right.
Okay, we're not nourishing them. Okay.
Yes.
So when we start having conversations with large organizations that feed people, very laudable work, and ask them how they're engaging regional farmers, or what is their plan to promote fresh produce within their feeding streams, it gets kind of ugly, really kind of quick, because that's hard. And you may have to diminish the number of people that you're reaching in these feeding programs, right? So the question then becomes one of, does this sector, because the numbers I reviewed with you earlier, this is a boom business that we're in. You can't argue that. It's a boom business. It's a growing business. I would love to have these stats and represent a commercial product, right? But have the problems that we've addressed grown 20% in the last 10 years? I would say no, they haven't. They haven't. The core of the societal deficits that we deal with the least domestically are the same. They may be a little bit more complex, but they're essentially the same, right? So what's going on here, right?
Jim, if we... So one of the things that I'm learning to push back on is this idea that we've convinced ourselves that we have to let the donor always feel like the hero in the story, that they're always sort of a cheat. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. If we begin to press our donors with the idea of actually solving problems, then rather than just sort of immediate needs, essentially the difference between what a lot of people are talking about, the difference between actually achieving justice and focusing on momentary charity, providing momentary charity for some, you know, giving them a bowl of soup or something. Does the notion of being a hero in their own little story, whatever's going on in their own little heads, sort of begin to diminish? I mean, that's part of the narrative that if we had 100 fundraisers in a room, especially in a direct response seminar or something, they're going to tell you one of the fundamental formulas that has to be built into every appeal that leaves your organization or mine has to make the donor feel like they're a hero.
Well, that's good business, right? Especially for the direct response community, right? That's good business.
Sure.
I don't think it's an either or, Jason, right? But I think it's an either and a little bit more. I think, first of all, nonprofit organizations have to develop sustainable programs that deal in a meaningful way with the predicates of the problems that they are dealing with. They have to be robust programs. They have to be well thought out. They have to be sustainable. They have to have measurable impacts, all right? And packaging those programs and presenting them to their donors. If we're saying the donor has to feel like a hero, if that's important, if that's the onion ring in my dinner, if you would please, all right, if that's important, then we have to present programs that are worthy of funding. But if I look at many of the organizations in this sector, if I look at their program suite really hasn't evolved in the last 20 years. It may have grown in scope, it may have gotten a bit more complex, but it hasn't evolved, right? So if we're presenting sustainable programs that have measurable impact and begin to change the narrative around the problems that we solve, is somebody going to feel more like a hero by supporting a program like that as opposed to supporting somebody getting a bowl of soup? I'm a donor to many organizations, and if somebody said, Jim, you could have an impact on rooting out hunger by this or providing a bowl of soup, I'm going to root out hunger. Now, understand, there are always going to be people that need that bowl of soup. All right, so we always have got to, we've always got to meet the needs of those that have profound need. All right, I understand that. But I believe that it's incumbent upon many of these organizations to develop sustainable programs that are worthy of investment, that drive sustainable change and address the predicates. If you go to the corporate or the foundation side, that's what they're funding. They get it. If you look at the changes in corporate and foundation funding over the last decade, it has changed profoundly. Just look at the changes, for example, in the Ford Foundation. It has changed profoundly. They want.
The argument I feel like you're making is very similar to the argument that Darren Walker's making at the Ford Foundation. But it sounds like you're a little more on the fence. You know, Darren Walker in his most recent book is talking about this difference between charity and justice.
Yes.
And I think the argument that the narrative that we've sold to the donor for too long is the charity narrative. It's the story of give them a bowl of food and sort of feed them for today and they'll come back tomorrow and need more. And that makes you feel like a hero, but that doesn't ultimately achieve justice. And I think what Walker's argument is, and what I think he's pushing for at the Ford Foundation, and I think we've ridden the fence on this for too long, and perhaps we played the charity card for so long. Now we're riding the fence, and I think at some point some of us are just going to have to leap over to the justice side and say, look, it's not going to be an and or sort of both sides sort of thing. Some of us, to actually achieve that goal, you've actually just got to narrowly focus on achieving that goal.
But Jason, my question is, why does the sector consistently engage, if you look at charity and justice, right, which is a great way of looking at this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do we engage in just that? Why is there such an emphasis on the charity side?
Because it keeps them employed.
Well, it's good for business. It's big business, right?
It's good for the CRM companies because the CRM companies keep getting names. Therefore, we have to keep putting data in it. It's good for the direct response companies because the direct response companies keep selling us new acquisition strategies. And it's good for the fundraiser because they never have to raise expectations so high so as to scare the donor that they currently have off. And it's good for Giving Tuesday because it's good for everybody around.
It's big business. Yeah. I don't think it's good for the people that we serve.
No, it's not.
It's big business. It's big business. And who wants to lose their job, right? So my point is this, is that I don't think it's a question of when will we? I think it's a question of we have to. I can give you an example at the Missions. So the Missions has been around for 85 years, and food is in our DNA, right? The Black Belt of the Deep South is also called the Stroke Belt. Somebody living in Dallas County, Alabama, has a higher mortality rate than somebody living in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Okay? All right. So, and in this country, that is an atrocity. It's an atrocity, and I use that word without moderation. Okay? So, if you look over 65 years of our history, our feeding programs, and we distribute 400 tons of groceries a year to the homebound. We provide over 400,000 meals a year, right? In a separate initiative. If you look over 75 years, our work didn't change. We got a new executive director named Chad McEachran who said, wait a minute. We're not helping people because we're getting our food donated, right, from large food banks, et cetera, high salt, high processed, et cetera, good people. And so the question was become, Chad asked the question, how can we move from feeding to nourishing people? How can we begin to address the health predicates that are plaguing this community, that are driving down workforce development, that are driving down educational excellence, all these things? And so we understood that the Black Belt of Alabama has one of the most robust produce markets in the country. That's why they call it the Black Belt. It's the soil, right? So we started working with regional African-American farmers that had been historically denied credit because of discriminatory practice. And we asked them the question, how can we buy our produce from you, The problem is, because these farmers were denied credit, they could not produce ahead of demand. They would produce 10 tons of okra, but I didn't need 10 tons of okra on April the 1st. I needed that okra to be cold packed so that we could use it throughout the year. So we began a micro-granting process to African-American farmers in the Black Belt to enhance their ability to produce ahead of our demand. So because of that initiative, if you look at the sodium that we've reduced from our feeding programs, you could line each grain of salt up on top of each other. You'd have the Washington Monument. All right? And we've enhanced the economic position of African-American farmers in the Black Belt to the point where farming now is drawing in younger people. So we've now created an economic engine within Dallas County. We've improved the dietary of the people that engage in our programs, and we've taken our lessons learned and imported it to the high school and to public learning. So this is what we're doing in terms of developing those sustainable solutions. So we've evolved the programs. We've made the investments. And I mean, it was involved so much that Hilton gave us a multi-million dollar commitment. You know, Hilton never invests, rarely invests in the U.S., right? So a multi-year commitment to build out these workforce development programs in and around nutrition. So that's what I mean about the evolution of programs. How are we evolving our programs to address the predicates of the services that we provide?
In the midst, Jim, in the midst of the pandemic, I was listening, I was reading a number of books. I was listening to a lot of the sort of the commentary that was coming from fundraising experts about how to navigate sort of the future and where this would go. And it was somewhat ironic because we had not experienced, you know, something of this magnitude and, you know, since the Spanish flu or something, none of which would have been relevant. You know, the world was a completely different world. And yet we had all these experts that were sort of telling us how this was going to sort of play out. But the thing that I wonder where this fits into your question. The thing that I sort of started to figure out is, which I think is in some ways one of the reasons why we don't like the idea of obsolescence and why we don't lean into the idea of actually sort of shutting our organizations down, is because we want to live in a much more predictable world. And that predictability comes with that charitable impulse. So the donor's impulse to give charitably, to give that person that bowl of food, rather than having to push them to give at a level that would actually solve this problem or to actually change their behavior, right? Change their behavior in very significant, monumental sort of ways, the way that they see, you know, paradigm shifting sort of change. I think it's because we like a very predictable and a certain degree of certainty. And so we all interact, we design our worlds. And maybe that's part of the reason why you're sort of provoking this conversation this morning, is because our world is becoming less and less predictable and therefore making it almost impossible to even make any ground even on the charitable, on the charity sort of side of this conversation. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, it makes sense. I don't agree with it. I see the merit of the argument. First of all, I don't think there are any fundraising experts. I don't. I wrestle with that.
Hey, brother, you worked for one of the ones in New York.
There are people with different troughs of experience and different passions, right? I'm not an expert. If I was an expert, I wouldn't be sitting here. You know, I can write a book, I guess. I think what we do, Jason, and I could be wrong, man. I don't know. I'm not a fundraising expert. I think we make things way too complex. And I think I'm always driven back to, if you look at every great story, what's the downfall of the hero in that story? And it's the old, it's the old notion of hubris of pride, right? So I think the nonprofit sector in this country, you know, why does England have 148,000 nonprofits and we have 10 times that? I think many of the nonprofits in this country believe their own mythology, right? They believe that if the services they provide were to go away, the people that they serve would be in extremis. My question is, what do you need to do in order so that if you go away, your people won't be in extremis anymore, right? And I tend to think it's an issue of hubris, but I also think it's an issue of economics. And I know that may not be a popular viewpoint, but I think it's largely where those two things intersect between hubris and economics. I really believe that. I'm not saying the people in these organizations are bad.
You don't think it's fear. You don't think it's You don't think it's risk avoidance and fear? So I'm putting it on the other side. I don't see our organization as arrogant. I see them fearful and risk avoidant.
I think changing the narrative, they're afraid of losing donors. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think absolutely they're afraid. But again, this goes back to my economic argument. If you start isolating donors and losing them, you're gonna lose money, right? But when you talk about an unpredictable world, you know, I'm 58 and my world, I mean, everybody said COVID's going to change the world. COVID really hasn't changed the world, I mean, except for the people that passed. And that was a
yes,
tragedy.
Yes.
But, you know, I grew up in the 80s, you know, when every day I woke up expecting nuclear bombs to rain on us. If I look at my father, I mean, they were engaged in a world war. I mean, so the world has not become any less predictable or any more predictable. I think human nature, by its very nature, is highly unpredictable. I think it's one of hubris in economics. I think it's one of people need us. We need to be here. We've been here for 100 years. We need to be here. And, you know, I think that's a big part of that. And I think, to your point, I think by changing the narrative from charity to justice, we're afraid of losing a big part. I think we're afraid of isolating our donors. So to that point, we're not really speaking truthfully to them. Right, we're not speaking.
Yeah, and that just gets at my consumer argument. We basically have to tell a story to the consumer to keep them coming back, and they always have to be dissatisfied with the experience to the extent that they're continuously shopping around. But that keeps the machine running. That's what keeps the process going. And ultimately, you know, if anything should be unpredictable about our world right now, it should be what, and I think this is ultimately to sort of bring us back to where you started, we should be that most unpredictable component of our current economy as a sector, because we should be the ones that should be taking, in my opinion, should be taking on the most risks,
yep,
reaching the furthest,
yep,
and taking the chance that we might very unpredictably solve a problem so that we can move on to something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the numbers that I reviewed with you in the beginning of the podcast, this should not be a growth industry. We should not be the third largest workforce in the United States.
Right.
We shouldn't be. We should not be contributing 5% to GDP. When you think about that, that horrifies me. That absolutely horrifies me. And what that tells me is I ask the question of the sector, what are we doing to go out of business? And for the last 20 years, the question has been, what can we do to grow? I mean, just the numbers reveal that.
So Jim, help me with this, because I've thought about this, and you've got me thinking, and I don't know that I've articulated this very well elsewhere. In some ways, I think what you and I are saying is that we're betraying. There's an underlying logic. Think about the other statistic that we haven't talked about here today, and it's that the 20 million donors that apparently are not giving to our organization now that were giving to us a couple decades ago. I think there's an underlying logic that we have betrayed, that the donor knows that we're supposed to actually be that type of risk-taking organization that actually solves problems and therefore makes ourselves obsolete. But because we're never actually doing that, I think we're betraying this implicit. I think the donor doesn't believe it. You can tell them that they're the hero all day long, but if they don't, if whatever you're letting them be the hero as a part of never actually gets done, they just stop believing it.
I think that's part of it. I also, I mean, we could do another 45 minutes on this. I've got some thoughts on this, but the loss, those 20 million, you know, I ask, what is the difference between the 20 million that we've lost and the 20 million that we haven't gained?
Right.
What is the difference there? And there's a lot of thoughts on that. I had an interesting conversation with my 15 and 16-year-old nieces about social justice. I said to them, well, what are you doing on the social justice issue? Well, we're on TikTok talking out. And my response was, well, why don't you get on buses like your uncle did, go down there and get into some good trouble? Oh, we couldn't do that. I don't know. I have some thoughts on it, but they're largely uninformed. But they are opinionated. I think the sector has, to a certain degree, lost some courage in that. I would agree with you. I think that's accurate.
See, I think that's a pretty profound statement. I don't know that I've had anybody.
I think we betrayed. I think to a large degree, present organization excluded, and others as well. I'm painting with a very broad brush here, and I'm going to get a lot of hate mail. But I think to some degree, the sector in the aggregate, Jason, make sure you underline that, I think we betrayed the people that we serve. So I think we have. And it's because we've gotten into the business of charity, and we have not figured out how we get into the business of justice. And that, to me, that's what keeps me working at 58 years old. And to be frank, that's what keeps me up at night, right? So, yeah.
So Jim, last thought. So one of the I read a book a number of years ago called The Fourth Turning, and The Fourth Turning is by a group of sort of futurist historians who basically look at sort of the cycles of human history, and they talk about this civic organization, which we generally recognize as sort of this. They would say that every fourth generation sort of experiences their life in the world very much the same way that four generations prior and four generations later will experience it. And part of what I think is a hopeful thought for you and I both, which is part of the language that I'm sort of weaving into a lot of my conversations, is that the millennial generation, so the generation that's subsequent to me and a lot of what my children will sort of experience, is a very civic-minded, citizen-like generation of people. And that's that person that, like you're talking to, the young person you were just referring to, I think they may actually sort of see the world differently than more consumer-oriented sort of perspective, and actually start asking some of these harder questions. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I would agree with you, but I think the challenge in that generation is what I would call constructive organizing. How are they organizing to drive change, not organizing to be heard? There's a difference. It's easy to be heard. It's harder to drive change.
Well, I don't think right. And I mean You and I are older. I think part of that organizing that you're talking about, I think in some ways is going to come through the technology that previous civically minded organizations, I mean, they didn't have iPhones, and right now they're just figuring out what the capabilities are with the iPhones, and people your age and my age don't even have a real sense of what these things are capable of.
And what's an iPhone, Jason? Go ahead.
But you know what I mean? I think my son on the other side of this wall here is 20 years old, soon to be 20 years old, and he doesn't know what the hell he's going to do. But I think if I look at sort of history and think about what generation sort of he represents using this fourth turning sort of framework, his generation might take to heart some of what you and I are asking today differently than others will.
I hope that happens. I will be hopefully alive to see it. If not, I'll shuttle off the coil with great anticipation and hope.
Right. So. Jim, we've had a wonderful conversation. Yeah, it sounds like we've provoked enough. We've provoked enough of each other's thinking that we could probably have you back. You're always welcome back. People who are listening oftentimes are interested in reaching out to the person in your seat more so than mine. How would you like people to do that?
If it doesn't include a firebomb, they can reach me on my LinkedIn profile, or they can reach me on email at jimkopp, 1964. It was a great year at gmail.com. jimkopp1964@gmail.com.
Jim, we'll be sure to put some information in the show notes about your organization. Certainly been a pleasure, and you're always welcome back.
The pleasure is mine, and have a great, great week.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.